From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Ala. I am here with 350 because I come from an island and it's very possible that it won't exist in the future.
350. That's the number scientists say is the safe upper limit of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. More than 4,500 events are planned in over 170 countries tomorrow for an International Climate Action Day. It's the most widespread day of political action in the globe's history. We'll speak with the co-founder of 350.org, environmentalist Bill McKibben, and with renowned Australian scientist Tim Flannery. Then a judge refuses to dismiss a war crimes case against the private military contractor Blackwater. We'll talk to investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill. And the Obama administration unveils a new strategy for Sudan.
Our strategy has three principal objectives. First, an end to conflict, gross human rights abuses, war crimes, and genocide in Darfur.
We'll speak with Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani, author of Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, at least 21 people are dead following a series of attacks earlier today. At least 17 people were killed when a bomb struck a bus traveling to a wedding in Pakistan's tribal belt. The attacks come as the Pakistani offensive against Taliban militants enters its seventh day. Tens of thousands of civilians have fled their homes since Pakistan launched the operation last week. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the U.S. is aiding the offensive in its most extensive involvement in a Pakistani military campaign to date. The U.S. military is sharing intelligence and surveillance video from Predator drones. It's believed to be the first time Pakistan's using intelligence from drone flights for a major military operation. Pakistan rejected the use of drone intelligence during its previous offensive against the Taliban last May. In Sri Lanka, some 4,000 ethnic Tamils have been released from government-run prison camps and cleared to return home. The freed civilians are among some 270,000 Tamils forced into the camps after the Sri Lankan civil war ended with bloody clashes earlier this year. Their release comes as the State Department has called on the Sri Lankan government to investigate what it calls credible allegations of war crimes during the civil war's final months. Between 7,000 and 20,000 Tamil civilians are believed to have died between January and May of this year. As the U.S. challenges Sri Lanka, the head of a U.N. inquiry into the U.S.-backed assault on Gaza is challenging the Obama administration to explain why it's worked to minimize the inquiry's findings that Israel committed multiple war crimes. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Judge Richard Goldstone said the White House had raised concerns about the report but hasn't explained them.
It seems to be still developing. It's been ambivalent, I think. The Obama administration joined our recommendation calling for a full good faith investigations both in Israel and in Gaza, but said that the report was flawed. But I've yet to hear from the Obama administration what the flaws in the report that they've identified are. I mean, I'd be happy to respond to them if and when I know what they are.
Last week, the U.S. voted against a U.N. Human Rights Council resolution endorsing the report's recommendations that both sides of the Gaza conflict probe war crimes allegations or face international prosecution. The resolution's been forwarded to the Security Council, where it's expected to face a U.S. veto. The U.S., meanwhile, has launched a joint Air Force drill with the Israeli military. The drill has been described in Israel as a preparation for an attack on Iran. U.S. Navy Rear Admiral John Richardson said the exercises would aid the Obama administration's revamped missile defense program.
This exercise is not directly related to recent announcements about ballistic missile defense in Europe, but the lessons and the insights that we gained from this exercise will certainly relate to developing that capability.
Ethiopia is appealing for $175 million in emergency food aid amidst the worst drought to hit eastern Africa in 10 years. Ethiopia says some 6.2 million people are in dire need of assistance. Humanitarian advocates say the appeal underscores the severity of Ethiopia's food crisis 25 years after the 1984 famine that killed 1 million people. In addition to emergency aid, Paul Smith Lomas of Oxfam said richer nations should allow Africa to become more self-sufficient in producing food.
When an emergency appeal like this comes out, the donors must respond and people do need food. But we also think the longer-term funding is needed too. Now, there are ways in which you can do a certain amount of both. If more money for emergency food aid was invested inside the region, then we could be recycling the economy far more. We could be promoting local agricultural investment far more than buying grain from somewhere on the other side of the world.
On Capitol Hill, the House Financial Services Committee has approved a measure that would create the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The White House-backed agency would monitor the products that banks and other institutions sell to consumers, including subprime loans. The finance industry has spent tens of millions of dollars on lobbying and advertisements trying to derail the proposal. The vote came as the Federal Reserve unveiled new measures to crack down on excessive Wall Street pay. Although the new Fed regulations would increase government oversight, they don't impose pay caps or bar multi-million-dollar compensation packages. The federal measures coincided with President Obama's announcement the Treasury Department would cut executive compensation at seven bailed-out Wall Street firms.
It does offend our values when executives of big financial firms, firms that are struggling, pay themselves huge bonuses, even as they continue to rely on taxpayer assistance to stay afloat.
Despite the celebrated pay cuts, three key executives at the notorious bailed-out firm AIG were allowed to keep their bonuses. White House pay czar Kenneth Feinberg said he relented after AIG argued the executives were critical to the company's long-term success. Feinberg said allowing the executives to keep their bonuses is in the public interest because it would allow the company to make enough money to pay back taxpayers for the bailout. In other news from Washington, concerns growing that Democratic leaders will lack the sufficient votes to include a public option as part of a health care reform bill. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's reportedly backing a plan that would establish a public option but allow individual states to opt out. Reid is said to be pushing the proposal despite acknowledging it could fall short in a Senate vote. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has reportedly determined she currently lacks the necessary votes to establish a, quote, robust public option. The news website Politico reports the vote count will likely lead to a weaker trigger proposal in which a form of the public option would only be established if the insurance industry fails to meet certain coverage goals. A new study, meanwhile, has found that many House members opposed to health care reform represent districts where the rate of uninsured exceeds the national average of 15%. According to the National Journal, 47% of House Republicans and 43% of Democrats represent districts that top the national average in numbers of uninsured. New figures released by New York Democratic Congressmember Anthony Weiner, meanwhile, show that 151 lawmakers in both chambers are currently covered by the government-funded health program, Medicare. The list includes 55 Republicans who Weiner says have steadfastly opposed the public option. Weiner said, quote, they apparently think the public option is okay for them, but not anyone else. Time magazine, meanwhile, is reporting the pharmaceutical industry spent $110 million on lobbying Congress in the first half of 2009. The figure amounts to $609,000 per day. Time reports there are now 2.3 drug industry lobbyists for every member of Congress. The Senate, meanwhile, has followed the House in voting to expand the definition of hate crimes to cover those targeted because of their sexual orientation. The measure would grant new protections to lesbian, gay, and transgender people under federal law. It's named after Matthew Shepard, the gay Wyoming University student who was brutally beaten, tied to a fence, and left to die in 1998. The measure has been sent to President Obama for his signature. New figures show unemployment rose in 23 states last month. According to the Labor Department, 43 states reported overall job losses, while only 7 states gained jobs. A coalition of popular recording artists is calling on the military to disclose whether their songs have been used as part of the torture and harsh interrogation of prisoners at Guantanamo. Bands including REM and Pearl Jam have endorsed Freedom of Information Act requests filed by the National Security Archives, asking the Pentagon to disclose which artists' music has been used. In West Virginia, 8 people have been arrested in a protest against mountaintop removal near the town of Corrier. The activists chain themselves to a coal truck and lay across a key mining road. The protest was staged by the group Climate Ground Zero. And a United Nations investigator has opened a probe into the U.S. housing crisis. Raquel Rolnick, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, will investigate issues including public housing, homelessness, and foreclosures. On Thursday, Rolnick held a public meeting with housing activists in New York.
If we take housing as a human right, you have to go back to the idea that housing is a social issue before and more priority than housing as a commodity, as a financial asset.
As part of her inquiry, Rolnick's expected to visit at least 6 other cities and towns, including Chicago, Los Angeles, and New Orleans. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. President Obama is heading to Massachusetts today, where he will urge the Senate to move forward on a climate change bill. The president's speech comes just 7 weeks before the start of the United Nations Copenhagen Climate Conference. Next week, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will hold 3 days of hearings to discuss the climate change bill proposed by Senators Barbara Boxer and John Kerry. While the Obama administration has acknowledged no bill will be passed before the Copenhagen talks, pressure is growing from grassroots organizations to take action. On Saturday, the group 350.org is organizing an International Climate Action Day. More than 4,500 events are scheduled to take place in 170 nations. 350.org is named after what scientists have identified as a sustainable target for carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million. We are currently at 387 parts per million. While most climate scientists say the effects of global warming are happening far sooner than initially projected, many Americans appear to be dismissing the threat of climate change.
A poll released on Thursday by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press found that just 57% of respondents believe there's solid evidence that the world's getting warmer, down 20 percentage points in just 3 years. The poll also found only 35% of Americans believe global warming's a very serious problem. Well, today we're joined by 2 of the major thinkers, writers, activists tackling climate change. With us here in New York at our Firehouse studio is writer and environmentalist Bill McKibben, co-founder and director of 350.org. 20 years ago, he published The End of Nature, the first general audience book about global warming. Bill McKibben has described the talks in Copenhagen as, quote, the most important diplomatic gathering in the world's history. We're also joined by the Australian scientist Tim Flannery. He's the author of the international bestseller, The Weathermakers. His latest book is called Now or Never: Why We Must Act Now to End Climate Change and Create a Sustainable Future. Tim Flannery is chair of the Copenhagen Climate Council. He's a mammalogist and paleontologist by training. As a field zoologist, he discovered and named more than 60 species. In 2007, Tim Flannery was named Australian of the Year. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! And as we go to broadcast, Bill, the protests, rallies, actions around the country in this largest day of global action in the history of the world are already underway.
People are jumping the gun a little bit, and we're getting amazing pictures beginning to arrive from places like Addis Ababa, from all across the Pacific, from New Zealand and Australia. It's quite remarkable to think that the largest day of political action in the planet's history will center around fairly arcane scientific fact, a data point. You would have said that it was too complicated for people or too hard for them to assimilate. But this is the most important number in the world. People are realizing that. People are realizing that their future, in the starkest terms, depends on the world's leaders understanding that this debate is not so much between the U.S. and China and the EU. It's mostly between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. And today and tomorrow, in 177 nations, people are standing up for the science, saying, pay attention to the real situation.
And yet there remains this huge disconnect between the American public and the public in the rest of the world. As we said, only about 35% of the American people believe this is a serious problem. Your understanding of why there is this huge disconnect?
Two things. One, we're the most addicted country in the world, so it makes sense that we'd be deepest in denial, I suppose. The second is, we've never really had a popular movement about climate. We've left this to the experts on the theory that if we keep repeating how bad the peril is, our leaders will take action. Now we're doing the work of building the kind of grassroots movement that changes hearts and minds, that moves people to understand what the problem is. And hopefully those images flooding in from around the world will really open people's hearts when they understand that people are protesting across Africa, across Asia, across Latin America, across places where people did nothing to cause this problem, but are willing to take a real role in helping to solve it.
Tim Flannery, you've been traveling the United States. Talk about the awareness in Australia and the awareness in the United States around global warming. What's your sense?
Well, Amy, you know, they're very different things. In Australia, it's impossible to avoid an understanding of climate change because it's in our face every day. We have terrible problems with water security at the moment across southern Australia. Our fifth largest city, Adelaide, may be out of drinking water next year. Our National Water Commissioner's said that he can't guarantee drinking water to that city as of the end of next year. We've had dust storms, we've had fires, we've had cyclones, we've had bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. And so no matter where you live in Australia, you become aware of climate change. Here in the US, I think you've been a little bit buffered, but from those changes, there's certainly some impacts, particularly in the western forests here, you can see it. But Australia is a harbinger, I think, for what will happen in the United States. But one of the big factors here that's so very different is that the population's views seem to be divided along political lines. It's a tragedy that, in a way, you know, the Democrats represent the proactive side and the Republicans seem to represent a side that wants to ignore the issue. Elsewhere in the world, that isn't the case. In Britain, for example, the Conservative Party is a very green party. So there's something about the political mix here and the sort of the relative insulation of the population from some of these changes that have made levels of awareness here much lower than elsewhere in the world. And that is such a problem for us because unless the US can move forward with its cap and trade bill to deal with this issue, I'm afraid many other countries are going to take a less than adequate stance during these negotiations in December.
Tim Flannery, you mentioned the problems that you've had there. You recently had the wildfires that took about 170 lives there. And here in the United States, obviously, wildfires, especially in the Southwest, have grown dramatically in recent years. But again, there's no connection that the public is making between these calamities and the overall change in the Earth's climate.
That's very strange to me. And maybe it's just that in Australia the situation is so stark. You know, up until 12 years ago in southeastern Australia, we enjoyed a regular winter rainfall regime. And the rain still falls, incidentally. It just falls over the Southern Ocean, about 200 miles south of where it used to fall. And we can all see that. We all experience the impacts of it. And somehow or other, it's become widely understood in the Australian public that this is the result of a changing climate. You really have to live in our country a little while, I think, to understand just how profound these impacts have been. There's no getting away from them. It's not just one phenomena. It's a series of things that have changed. And everyone who takes an interest in this issue really does understand it.
Tim, in your book, Now or Never, you take the reader on a guided tour of the environmental challenges we face and the potential solutions, big and small. Take us on that tour right now.
Sure, I will. Look, you know, the thing is, as Bill said, 350 is the key figure. And that means the problem is a lot more pressing than we realised even 5 years ago. The science has moved forward. Our understanding of how CO2 impacts the Earth's climate system has grown. And so we know that there is that very tight deadline. We need to both reduce our emissions and we need to get some gas out of the air. Ideally, in terms of reducing emissions, we need to either close down or retrofit every conventional coal-fired power plant on the planet by 2030. Now, that is an enormous job. I mean, and retrofit it with carbon capture and storage. It's the only other option. That's a huge job, and I don't think we'll get that. So we're going to have to attack this issue from a series of different directions. We're going to have to increase our efficiency of transport use and move to electric cars as soon as we can. We're going to have to build as much new energy infrastructure as we can, wind, photovoltaics and so forth. And we're also going to have to use the power of the planet to draw some of the gas out of the air. And there we have a great ally, which is plants and forests. Plants draw out of Earth's atmosphere 8% of all atmospheric carbon dioxide every year. They represent the world's most wonderful carbon capture mechanism. And what we've got to do is build some capacity for storage among those plants. And that means protecting forests, improving agricultural practices, fighting desertification, which releases carbon from the soil, a series of things that will let us live more sustainably and represent win-wins. So they're just a few of the things we need to do as we move forward.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Our guests are Tim Flannery, voted Australian of the Year 2007, and Bill McKibben, co-founder and director of 350.org. 20 years ago it was that he published The End of Nature. 350.org has organized, well, more than 4,000 actions in more than 170 countries around the world. Stay with us.
Big green groups there, hesitating to tell the urgent truth. It's so damn frustrating. Lobby hard, they say, and we'll pass legislation. Cap and trade alone, it'll be our salvation. And BP, they tell us, is cooperating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. But look around you now, it's so energizing. October 24th, we're organizing a planet-wide day of climate campaigning to heed McKibben's call for global action. For 350, oh, the only path to salvation, the most important number in the whole damn nation. Let's not reverse course of Almighty's creation, so don't tell me over and over and over again, my friends, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Eve of Destruction, New Millennium, originally by Barry McGuire. New lyrics by Ken Ward, performed by the JP House Band, Andre Zaleska and Ken Ward. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, public access TV stations, PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. If you're involved in an action around the globe, as we broadcast around the globe this weekend, we hope you will write to us and let us know what you're doing, send us pictures. You can write to us at stories@democracynow.org. You can also send us video as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest, Tim Flannery, Australian scientist and writer, Australian of the Year 2007, new book out, Now or Never, Why We Must Act Now to End Climate Change and Create a Sustainable Future, and, well, Bill McKibben, who is co-founder and director of 350.org, behind the massive protests, rallies, actions that are taking place this weekend around the globe. Juan?
Well, Bill McKibben, I'd like to ask you, perhaps one of the most extraordinary of these protests is the president of the Maldives is leading 350 scuba divers to the coral reefs off his country to show the destruction there. Could you talk about the coral reefs and the oceans and the impact of global warming on our oceans?
One of the things 20 years ago that we had no idea was going to happen as we poured carbon into the atmosphere was that the ocean would become steadily more acidic. In the last few years, scientists have identified that as a threat almost as enormous as the steady heating of the Earth's atmosphere. There are countries like the Maldives, like many small island nations, that may not make it through this century. I mean, the Maldives have been there for 4,000 years, people living on them, an intact working culture. They're setting aside money each year in their budget now, though they're a poor country, to buy a new homeland, God knows where, sometime in the future when their current one disappears. It's not just that the ocean's rising, it's that these acidifying seas are wrecking the coral reefs that guard, that fringe these islands and guard them. That's why 92 nations now have endorsed this 350 target. Now, they're the poorest nations on Earth, the victim nations, the first places that are going to go under, the African nations that are vulnerable to drought. But those are the people who are beginning finally to get aggressive and to understand that there's not enough aid in the world to take care of the scale of problems that are coming at them if we don't reduce emissions fast.
And one of the points that you raised is that when you attended the Kyoto meetings back in 1997, the main battles there were between Europe and the United States over what kind of accords would be reached, but that increasingly now these poorer countries are taking center stage with their own demands.
That's right. And there's a whole new set of players. China, for instance, though their per capita emissions are quite small compared to, say, Americans, they're increasing rapidly and will be an important part of this thing, which is makes me very happy that we have 300 big rallies across China this weekend. China's not an easy place to do political organizing. This is the first thing like this that's ever happened there. 250 or 300 rallies across India, which will be the other really powerful player. These places are starting to wake up and to understand. There's an area about the size of Italy in Tibet, where there are glaciers that form the headwaters of the Mekong, the Salween, the Yangtze, the Yellow, the Ganges, and the Brahmaputra. One human being in three lives downstream from these glaciers. We now think the one at the head of the Ganges may be gone by 2035. There's no backup plan. There's no plan B for what you do across the Gangetic Plain once those glaciers disappear. We're talking about by far the biggest challenge that human beings have ever faced. And so far, as effective as the scientific method has been in analyzing that problem, that's how ineffective the political method has been in dealing with it. And one of the reasons is there's never been a movement to push. We need to build that movement fast.
Earlier this week, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown urged President Obama and Chinese Prime Minister Hu Jintao to join him and personally attend the Copenhagen talks.
And let me just say how important I believe your discussions today are. In every era, there are one or two moments when nations come together and reach agreements that make history. They change the course of history. And Copenhagen must be such a time. There are now fewer than 50 days to set the course for the next few decades. So as we convene here, we carry great responsibilities, and the world is watching. If we do not reach a deal over the next few months, let us be in no doubt, since once the damage from unchecked emissions growth is done, no retrospective global agreement in some future period can undo that choice. By then, it will be irretrievably too late. So we should never allow ourselves to lose sight of the catastrophe we face if present warming trends continue.
Tim Flannery, your response. It does look like President Obama will be going because he's going to be going to get the Nobel Peace Prize in the region anyway, so he would be right there. It would be more of a comment if he didn't go than if he did.
I'm not sure, Amy, that President Obama is going to attend the meeting. All of that hangs in the balance at the moment. And really, the only hope we have now is for the heads of government to attend this meeting, because the traditional negotiating process has become completely bogged down. and we need the key decision makers there to at least agree a sort of a heads of agreement meeting where we can, you know, lay out the main things we want to do and then over the following months fill out the detail of how all of that's going to be allocated. So Gordon Brown is absolutely right. It's critical that heads of state attend. But unfortunately, at the moment, we're still in a position where that is far from certain. In fact, Todd Stern recently said it was unlikely that President Obama would be attending. So it all hangs in the balance. The next 50 days are incredibly important. What 350.org is doing is extraordinarily important. But could I just say to you, the key block at the moment is the US Senate. You know, if the cap and trade bill passes, President Obama, or looks like it's going to pass, President Obama can go to those meetings in good faith and say, here is what our nation is going to do. Here's the cap. And that's what's required of any international negotiation. Without that bill, I'm afraid that not only the US will fail to have a cap, but Australia and Canada will follow suit. And we were bound by the Kyoto Protocol, so that's a major step backward. It is just so critically important in this country that the policy gets sorted out to give the president credibility and to lead, because that's what we need right now.
Can we play for you recent comments by Republican senators on the Boxer Kerry climate bill?
It can't be denied that this would be the largest tax increase in the history of America.
The Kerry-Boxer bill is a giant new energy tax on families and workers.
Your electricity rates, your gasoline per gallon costs are going to go up. This is not the time to be adding costs.
What we know that is going to raise prices for American families, it's going to make it much tougher for American families.
All we know is that everything is going to go up. Electricity is going to go up, diesel fuel is going to go up, natural gas is going to go up, fertilizer is going to go up.
Just an example of some of the opposition, Tim Flannery, your response.
Look, there is no doubt there will be modest cost increases across some of those areas, most of which can be dealt with, incidentally, by just some efficiency gains in very, very simple ways. But, you know, unless we invest in the future now in that regard, American manufacturing and American industry is going to suffer greatly over the next decade or two. And the reason for that is that countries like China are now moving ahead with their eye firmly on that market of 5 billion people around the planet who can't get enough energy. We know that we can't deliver that energy to those people using traditional means. We'll pollute the planet out of existence. So the big gains to be had over the next decade or two or three are building the new energy economy. And America needs to invest in that, so its own manufacturers and its own chambers of commerce and businesses are in a good position to take a slice of that enormous market that's emerging. So unless we get the cap and trade bill through and unless the appropriate investments are made, this country is going to lose its place in the world, I'm afraid. We can see that already happening with China moving ahead so swiftly. So yes, there'll be some increase now, modest increase now. It's not going to send anyone broke. We've seen that in Europe. We've seen their economy expand and prosper as they've taken on cap and trade. But the investment is critical.
And yet there are some members of the environmental movement here in the United States who question the use of the cap and trade as a means of addressing the problem. Could you respond to that, to those concerns?
Sure. Look, cap and trade by itself is not enough. But it is essential in terms of these international negotiations. And one way of showing that is look at the alternatives. Just say the US went with a carbon tax. That would leave the president in a position where he'd be going to Copenhagen and saying, look, we've got a carbon tax, but we've got no idea really what it's going to do in terms of our emissions profile. So countries would just say, well, what are you actually pledging to? How are you going to deal with your emissions? You know, the only method really to allow countries to see transparently what other countries intend to do and then share the burden equally is through a cap and trade system. So it's not enough to deal with emissions overall, but it is an essential prerequisite for any global deal on climate change.
On the issue of cap and trade, many environmental and watchdog groups have opposed the system. This is Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen about cap and trade on Democracy Now!
Look, Public Citizen supports strong, effective climate legislation, and the fact is that this bill does not do that. We can talk about the aspirations of hoping to achieve greenhouse gas emissions reductions, but when you look at what this bill will do, it will not result in significant reductions. It creates a legal right to pollute for industries and gives away credits for free to allow companies to meet those targets without having to pay for them. And that is simply not going to spur the kind of investments we need. President Obama had it right when he announced in his budget in February that if you wanted to pollute, you would have to pay for the right to pollute. And by holding an auction, the government would raise hundreds of billions of dollars that could be reinvested back to the American people to offset the impacts of higher energy prices that a cap-and-trade program would bring, and to spur billions of dollars in needed investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy.
Tim Flannery.
Look, cap-and-trade does work. It does do part of the job we need to do to get to where we need to go. We see that in Europe. They had a similar system of giving away permits. But the 5% reduction over 1990 levels that cap-and-trade system was intended to generate have actually happened. The US, I know the bill isn't perfect, I know there's a lot of giveaways in it, and I know a lot of people are unhappy about provisions for subsidies for nuclear power and so forth, but we just have to get moving on this. We have to empower the president of the most powerful nation on earth to be able to negotiate and lead. And cap and trade is really about that. And besides, I really do have faith that that system will bring about the reductions of 14 or 17% below 2005 levels that it pledges. It's a comprehensive bill. In the agricultural area, it is really good. It does things that no other nation has really looked at doing. So could I just make a personal plea to Americans to support this bill? Imperfect as it is a first absolutely essential step for this country to engage and lead and empower others in other parts of the world.
Well, Tim, as you head off to the airport to increase your carbon footprint, we'll let you go because I know you have to catch that flight. Tim Flannery, Australian scientist and writer, Australians of the Year 2007, has a new book called Now or Never, Why We Must Act Now to End Climate Change and Create a Sustainable Future. But Bill McKibben is with us. Not that he's off the hook around increasing his carbon footprint since I think he's traveled the entire globe in the last 30 days, but Juan?
Yeah, Bill, I'd like to ask you about these solutions in Congress, not only in the Senate, but also the Waxman-Markey bill in the House, and how you think that they are addressing the U.S. role in terms of reducing its own carbon footprint.
They're clearly the text from which people are working now. They've got to be strengthened if they're going to do what we need them to do. They've got to be strengthened a lot in a lot of ways. One of the things where they fall the shortest is when we get to Copenhagen, part of the deal is going to be how much aid in terms of technology and resources will go north to south in order to let countries leapfrog over the fossil fuel era and so on. The British government estimated recently that it would take about $100 billion of aid a year to help countries adapt in the poor parts of the world and to help them make this transition. That number, $100 billion, may be low to begin with, but the two bills in Congress allocate about $750 million with an M dollars to this task. That's derisory. It's an insult going to Copenhagen, considering the fact that the 4% of us who live here have produced 25% of the world's CO2. It's why we're so happy that this weekend there'll be 1,800 events taking place in all 50 states across the U.S., not just the biggest day internationally, but the biggest day of climate action in U.S. history. We need some pressure on Washington and on Copenhagen.
Well, especially isn't it true, since much of the pollution created by industries in the third world is really a result of European and American-based multinationals who have established their production facilities and their mining facilities and all their operations in these third world countries.
Juan, there's that. And there's also, probably even more powerfully, you know, we're spreading quickly the notion of what modernity is supposed to look like. And if modernity only means riding around in your own automobile and having a big flat-screen TV and trying always to build a bigger house farther apart from your neighbors, which has been the American dream for half a century, then we don't have a prayer. Our influence in this has been overwhelming, and we need to take real responsibility now.
Bill McKibben, finally, on this issue of President Obama, he just went to Copenhagen to push for the Olympics taking place in Chicago. Is there really a question about whether he will go back there on this issue? You have called this meeting perhaps the most important meeting to take place in world history. Why do you say that?
Here's the thing about Obama and Copenhagen and everything else. we can't blame our leaders yet because we haven't built the kind of movements that demand that they do things and that give them the political space to do it. If Copenhagen is a failure, that failure will be measured not in decades but in geological time. President Obama can't let it be a failure. None of us can let it be a failure. Everybody who's listening to this, there's a rally or event happening within a few miles of their home tomorrow. If they go to 350.org, they can find out exactly where it is. Make some noise. We've got no right to complain about our leaders until we've given them the leadership they need. That's how it works.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Bill McKibben, co-founder, director of 350.org. It was 20 years ago that he published The End of Nature. Democracy Now! Will be in Copenhagen for the 2 weeks of the conference in December. We'll be broadcasting to you every day. And bringing you the reports of what's happening in the streets, what's happening in the meetings, and what's happening around the world. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, a quick update on the Supreme Court decision around Blackwater, and then we're going to talk about U.S. policy. Is it changing in regards to Sudan and Darfur? Stay with us.
سمعتك تخلي الدنيا شمسية في غمزة طفلة تشرع وتتسرع إذا باريتي بالأبانوس سنيناتك سمعتك سمعتك الجروب مقصورة به وهج القناديل وشوف برقني غازل وامضو سرا في عويناتك وشوف شوف معي أشيرو للقميرة تعي دورك بالمناديل
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. That's the Sudanese legend Mohamed Wardi playing the tambour. We're going to talk about Sudan in a minute. But right now, we turn to a major decision here in the United States. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Well, a federal judge has rejected a series of arguments by lawyers for the private military contractor Blackwater, who were seeking to dismiss five war crimes cases brought by Iraqi victims against the company and its owner, Eric Prince. At the same time, the judge ruled that lawyers for the Iraqi plaintiffs need to amend and refile their cases to provide more specific details on the alleged crimes before a decision can be made on whether the lawsuits will proceed. Susan Burke, the lead attorney for the Iraqi victims, told The Nation magazine she was very pleased with the ruling, while Blackwater spokesperson Stacey DeLuke said, quote, "We are confident that the plaintiffs will not be able to meet the high standards specified in the judge's opinion."
For more, we're joined by Democracy Now! Video stream by award-winning journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, author of the international bestseller Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. His article on the ruling is available online at thenation.com. Jeremy, welcome to Democracy Now! It's being played by the mainstream media as a huge defeat for those who are taking on Blackwater, but you have a very different take. Explain.
Well, I mean, when I got up yesterday morning and saw all these headlines from the Associated Press and other media outlets saying that a federal judge had tossed out all of the lawsuits against Blackwater, I was actually quite stunned. I mean, that would have been a devastating development for the Iraqi victims of the company. But then I actually got the 56-page ruling from Judge T.S. Ellis, who, by the way, is a Reagan appointee, and I read it. And actually, what you see in this document is that it's a very well thought out legal argument by Judge Ellis, where he's essentially saying to Blackwater, your argument that you can't be sued as a private company under the Alien Tort Statute is false. your argument that private individuals or companies cannot commit war crimes is false.
Whoops, looks like we just lost Jeremy. Jeremy's speaking to us by video stream. We're going to try to get him back on, and we'll try to get him on the phone. But right now, we'll do that for the end of the show. We will turn to our next guest. That considered just a tease for the rest of that subject. Juan?
Well, after months of deliberation, the Obama administration unveiled a new strategy for Sudan on Monday. The White House plans to offer the Sudanese government a mix of incentives and pressure to urge Khartoum to end the crisis in Darfur and implement a 2005 peace deal between the North and the South. The new policy promises broad engagement with Khartoum, but no direct talks with President Omar al-Bashir, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced the administration's Sudan policy on Monday.
Our strategy has three principal objectives. First, an end to conflict, gross human rights abuses, war crimes, and genocide in Darfur. Second, implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that results in a united and peaceful Sudan after 2011, or an orderly path toward two separate and viable states at peace with each other. And third, a Sudan that does not provide a safe haven for terrorists.
The specific incentives that might be offered to Sudan and the repercussions Sudan could face for non-compliance, whether diplomatic, economic or military, remain classified. The Sudanese government reacted cautiously to the new policy. This is Ghazi Saleh Eden, the advisor to the Sudanese president.
This strategy lacks any tangible steps for the American administration to commit to. The U.S. assumes that Sudan should take actions while its own role is only to evaluate and respond to these actions.
For more on Washington's new Sudan strategy, we're joined here in our Firehouse studio by the African Studies scholar Mahmoud Mamdani. He's the Herbert Lehman Professor of Government and Professor of Anthropology at Columbia University, author of several books, his latest is Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror. Professor Mamdani, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
The U.S. policy right now. Has it changed?
Yes, it has changed. The U.S. policy, I think, is first and foremost an acknowledgement that conditions on the ground have changed. As Hillary Clinton said in her speech, the level of mortality in Darfur declined dramatically after 2005. It's a recognition, it's an acknowledgement that high-level U.N. officials have also said this over the last 6 months. The outgoing head of the UN mission said that the conflict in Darfur was a low-intensity conflict. The outgoing commander of UNAMID forces said there's no longer a war in Darfur, that the main problem for refugees to return home is banditry in the countryside. So first of all, it's an acknowledgement that conditions have changed. Second, it's an acknowledgement that the U.S. Needs an integrated Sudan policy, not a separate policy for Darfur and a separate policy for the south of Sudan, that, in fact, U.S.-Sudan policy has tended to be driven by the activist constituency strongest in the U.S. in relation to Darfur, whereas the real issue is south-north, South Sudan. And finally, it's a recognition that whereas conditions in Darfur have been improving, conditions in the south have been deteriorating. And Sudan, with all these deadlines of an election next year and a referendum the year after, is beginning to resemble a pressure cooker on the boil.
It's certainly a shift in how President Obama regards this, because back in when he was running for president in April 2008, he said he criticized the Bush administration, saying, "I'm deeply concerned by reports that the Bush administration is negotiating a normalization of relations with the government of Sudan. This reckless and cynical initiative would reward a regime in Khartoum that has a record of failing to live up to its commitments." So there appears to be at least a willingness now by the administration to deal with the with the leadership.
Well, I think that Obama then, at the time of that speech, was responding to the domestic constituency in the U.S., particularly the Save Darfur movement. Obama now is responding to the situation in Sudan and to the realization that the ideological nature of Save Darfur demands has made for an extremely inflexible U.S. response to Sudan. That the language of genocide has made it very difficult to negotiate with the government in power. Just take the difference between the South and Darfur. The war in the South had been going on for much longer in Darfur. The numbers of people killed in the South were many more than in Darfur. And yet the language of genocide was never used in the South, in spite of the fact that killings were mainly racialized in the South, ethnicized in Darfur. It was possible in the South to have protracted negotiations. It has not been possible to do so in Darfur.
Talk about whether there is a split in the administration, the Obama administration. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, Andrew Natsios, who is the, what, former head of AID, the special envoy to Sudan for Bush in 2006 and 7, told Time magazine there's a war in the Obama administration. On the one hand, Major General Scott Gration. On the other hand, Susan Rice.
Yes, I think that's true. Susan Rice has been very closely related to the Save Darfur movement. Scott Gration
is the U.S. ambassador.
She's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Scott Gration, the new envoy, is more or less in line with previous envoys, in the sense that Andrew Natsios was the envoy under Bush, and the State Department has been hugely skeptical of the claims of Save Darfur movement. Natsios began very sympathetic to Save Darfur and ended his period extremely skeptical of it. There is a deep division inside the Obama administration, not only between those close to Save Darfur and those critical of it, but also inside Save Darfur now, between those who are much more central to the evangelical lobby, which is attuned to the South, as opposed to those organized mainly in relation to Darfur. The evangelical lobby is also worried that Sudan policy has been driven too much by a Darfur orientation, and that, in fact, the South, which is the main story, has become neglected as Sudan resembles more of a pressure cooker on the boil and moves towards this deadline of 2011.
And yet you have also been criticized by those who support, say, Darfur. Nicholas Kristof, for instance, in the New York Times, talked about your book, Saviors and Survivors, calling it an error-filled polemic, as being one that is trying to paper over or not cover up, but certainly excuse the kinds of killings that have occurred in the past. Your response to that?
Well, I mean, Nicholas Kristof wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books, and basically he was defending himself in a sense. And his point of view, as the point of view of Save Darfur, is that anybody who tries to explain the context of the violence in Darfur and to direct attention from atrocities to the issues that have been fueling the violence is doing nothing but apologizing for the violence. My own point of view is that if you are interested in stopping the cycle of violence, you have no choice but to look at the issues that feed that violence. A focus exclusively on the atrocities is like creating and catering to a pornography of violence, which is what Save Darfur has been doing.
How do you think people concerned about violence in Darfur, in southern Sudan, in Democratic Republic of Congo should direct their energies?
I think they have to look at the issues, and they have to be critical of the new kind of movements that have arisen in the U.S. I would say Save Darfur is the best example of it. Just contrast it with the anti-war movement of the 60s or the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s. These were basically educational movements. Issues were at the center of these movements. Their major activity, their signature activity, was the teach-in. Save Darfur has no interest in teaching. It has no interest in education, nor in educators. Its interest is in Hollywood celebrities. Its interest is in name recognition. Its interest is not even in the university students, less and less now, much more so in high school students. I call them America's counterparts of the child soldiers of Africa. Children led into causes without understanding them. I think there has to be a certain degree of critical focus on Save Darfur type movements, that they do not really strengthen democracy, they weaken it.
What about the U.S. government's relations with Sudan in terms of the war on terror? Has that influenced at all, you think, how the U.S. government is dealing with Sudan?
I think the U.S. government has had steady relations with Sudan on the war on terror. Relations between the two intelligence services have been strong, I would say. But what has influenced the U.S. mainly is a recognition that an ideologically based policy has led to inflexibility. It needs an interest-based policy. So interest can be oil, for example, is an important interest. So it's trying to shed the language of genocide. That's really what this is about. If we heard Secretary Clinton, the very first sentence was a reference to genocide, and that's a bone of contention between Gratian and Kerry in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and Secretary Clinton, Susan Rice. But this will unfold over the next few months, as if the policy succeeds, the unnamed carrots will have to be dished out, which is basically the sanctions policy.
What do you think is the motive of Save Darfur? What's your analysis of that organization and groups like ENAF?
Well, I think Save Darfur basically, I've been trying to figure this out. There were different kinds of groups that went into Save Darfur for different kinds of motives. There were those who came out of the South Sudan campaign and who just assumed that Darfur was another version of South Sudan, which it wasn't. There were those who were mainly motivated by lessons of the Rwanda genocide, and they assumed that really a time comes when you can't sort of stop and ask, why is this happening? You must first act. And if you ask them what's the time, they would say genocide. And if you ask them how do you know it's genocide, they would say because we're told so. Now, that's the real rub. We're told so by whom? So the genocide has become like an ideological language used by those who want to forefront a particular issue.
Well, Professor Mamdani, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor at Columbia University of Government and Anthropology. His latest book is Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror. As we go back right now to Jeremy Scahill to try to complete that conversation on the issue of a federal judge rejecting a series of arguments by lawyers for the private military contractor Blackwater, who are seeking to dismiss five war crimes cases brought by Iraqi victims against the company and its owner, Eric Prince. Jeremy, we've got you back on the Democracy Now! Video stream. Very quickly, explain the significance of the case.
Well, I mean, basically, these are five cases brought by Iraqi civilians that were allegedly wounded by Blackwater and the families of Iraqis that were killed by Blackwater. These are very high-stakes cases. Blackwater is fighting passionately to have them thrown out. They've made arguments that they, as a company, can't be sued, that it would violate the rights of the President of the United States to make battlefield decisions, and if Blackwater was prosecuted, that would infringe upon the President's rights. They've said that they, as a company, can't be sued for war crimes because war crimes can only be committed by state actors or nations. And what we saw here is that this conservative Judge Ellis said to Blackwater, no, none of that is valid. What he did do, though, is he referenced a Supreme Court decision in May, Ashcroft v. Iqbal, which really reversed decades of case law and made it very, very difficult, more difficult, for plaintiffs to have their cases move to the trial phase. In other words, the bar was set much higher to proceed to trial. So what the judge said to Susan Burke and the Center for Constitutional Rights, the lawyers representing these Iraqis, you need to refile your cases with more evidence, and then we'll take it from there. So while it's being portrayed by the corporate media as a judge tossing out these cases, that quite clearly is not the case. This was actually a pretty significant defeat for Blackwater and a victory not only for the Iraqis in this case, but also for those lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights that have spent decades trying to apply U.S. laws to crimes committed abroad. Blackwater remains in very, very hot water, not only because of this case, but also the U.S. Justice Department is going to begin its prosecution of five Blackwater operatives for manslaughter charges relating to the Nisr Square massacre in September of 2007. This is very high-stakes stuff, and the corporate media got it basically absolutely wrong.
Jeremy Scahill, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, award-winning journalist. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire from the Caduceus, Aramata, Angelique Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.